Indeed, Fritz Hoffmann proved to be a great asset for the classified program. Within months of his arrival at Edgewood, he was delivering work of a high order and had shown considerable ingenuity and excellent knowledge, according to a declassified internal review of his performance. Tobin work progressed. When military intelligence learned that the Soviets' Chemical Works No. 91 was also producing sarin, Edgewood was told to continue working on Tobin, but also to redouble efforts in sarin production, with a plan to start producing it on an industrial scale as soon as possible. Project A113 was given even higher priority and a new code name, Project A113 2.1. In Germany, Nazi scientists with knowledge of Tobin and sarin were now even more aggressively sought for recruitment into Operation Paperclip. Declassified documents reveal that the Chemical Corps wanted to employ Otto Ambrose, but he was not available. Ambrose was incarcerated inside the prison complex at Nuremberg, awaiting a war crimes trial. Imprisoned alongside Ambrose were fellow Farben board members Fritz Tiermaer and Karl Krau, as well as Hermann Schmitz, Farben's powerful CEO and the man who kept the Auschwitz scrapbook hidden in a secret wall safe. SS Brigade Führer Dr. Walter Schieber, Ambrose's liaison to the Speer Ministry and the man who oversaw the work at Düren-Fort, was also high on the paperclip target list. But recruitment of Schieber would have to wait. Schieber was also being held at Nuremberg. The IG Farben trial, officially called United States of America versus Karl Krau et al., was scheduled to begin in a few months, in the summer of 1947. Time would tell who, if any, of Hitler's chemists would become available. It had been a little over 4 months since the New York Times had broken the story of Operation Paperclip, and the negative attention to the program had not subsided. Then, on March 9, 1947, journalist Drew Pearson reported the most outrageous news story about Operation Paperclip to date. According to Pearson, the U.S. Army had offered Farben executive Karl Krau a paperclip contract while he was incarcerated at Nuremberg. Krau was the lead defendant in the upcoming war crimes trial. He had served as Göring's plenipotentiary for chemical production and had advocated for the use of nerve agents against the Allies. Krau was the man who galvanized his fellow German industrialists to mobilize resources to help the Nazis go to war. Drew Pearson's column, Washington Merry-Go-Round, was widely read and highly influential, and the report about Krau caused such a scandal that General Eisenhower, the U.S. Army Chief of Staff, demanded to know what was going on with Operation Paperclip. The man who briefed Eisenhower was Chief of Military Intelligence Stephen J. Chamberlain. After what was reported to be a 20-minute meeting, General Eisenhower remained in support of the paperclip program. For the military chiefs inside the JOA, the problems with the public's perception of paperclip were almost universally blamed on the State Department. Dean Rusk, who worked in the office of the Assistant Secretary of War, summed up JOA's attitude toward the State Department in a memorandum the day after the Eisenhower briefing. "The public relations people are feeling mounting pressure on the German scientist business. Our position is inherently weak because the State Department finds this whole program difficult to support." The JOA decided it was time to get rid of Samuel Klaus. Director Thomas Ford wrote General Stephen Chamberlain saying that Klaus was obnoxiously difficult and needed to be removed. Within the week, Klaus was transferred from the visa section of the State Department to the office of the legal advisor. He no longer had any say over the policies and procedures regarding Operation Paperclip. It remains a mystery if Klaus had anything to do with the public's perception of the program, but in years to come, and as McCarthyism expanded, Klaus would be accused of having leaked negative stories about the German scientist program to the press. But even with Klaus banished from the program, for the first time since Paperclip's inception in the spring of 1945, the entire operation was now in danger of collapse. Assistant Secretary of War Howard Peterson worried with colleagues that the War Department would be buried in scandals involving Nazi scientists. Peterson predicted that the whole program would be shut down in a matter of months. Instead, the opposite happened. With the signing of the National Security Act by President Truman on July 26, 1947, America's armed services and intelligence agencies were restructured. The War Department was reconstituted into the Department of Defense. The State War Navy Coordinating Committee became the National Security Council, and the Central Intelligence Agency was born. A new age was dawning for the controversial paperclip program. On the one hand, it struggled to hold up a false face of scientific prowess, behind which lay a tawdry group of amoral war opportunists, many of whom were linked to war crimes. But just as Von Braun admitted to New Yorker writer Daniel Lang that what he really cared most about was seeing how the golden cow could be milked most successfully, the newly created CIA saw the paperclip scientists in similar quid pro quo terms. There was advantage to be had in using men who had everything to lose and were, at the same time, uniquely focused on personal gain. In Operation Paperclip, the CIA found a perfect partner in its quest for scientific intelligence. And it was in the CIA that Operation Paperclip found its strongest supporting partner yet. Sometime in the spring of 1947, scientists at Edgewood Arsenal began conducting human experiments with Tabin nerve agent. All soldiers used in these experiments were so-called volunteers, but the men were not made privy to the fact that they were being subjected to low-level concentrations of Tabin. Some of the tests took place in Utah at the Dugway Proving Ground. Other tests took place inside Edgewood's Gassing Chamber for Human Tests, a 9-by-9-foot tile-and-brick cube with an airtight metal door. One of the people observing the Tabin tests was Dr. L. Wilson Green, technical director of the Chemical and Radiological Laboratories at the Army Chemical Center at Edgewood, and a close collaborator of Fritz Hoffmann's. Green was a short man with a square jaw and a barrel chest. What he lacked in height, he made up for in vision. While observing the behavior of the soldiers in the Tabin gas experiments, L. Wilson Green had a revelation. Green noticed that after soldiers were put in the gassing chamber, they became partially disabled for from 1 to 3 weeks, with fatigue, lassitude, complete loss of initiative and interest, and apathy. What struck Green most was that the men were wholly incapacitated for a period of time, but not permanently injured. The men recovered entirely on their own. The antidote was time. Dr. L. Wilson Green saw in this a new kind of warfare. He sat down and began outlining his idea for America's warfighting future in an opus that would become known as Psychochemical Warfare, a New Concept of War. In the monograph, Green wrote, the trend of each major conflict being characterized by increased death, human misery, and property destruction could be reversed. His seminal vision for psychochemical warfare, a term he coined, was to incapacitate a man with drugs on the battlefield, but not to kill him. Green believed that in this way, the face of warfare could change from barbaric to human. Incapacitating agents were gentle weapons. They knocked a man out without permanent injury. With psychochemical warfare, Green explained, America could conquer its enemies without the wholesale killing of people or the mass destruction of property. Green was not proposing to use low levels of tabin gas on the battlefield. He was talking about using other kinds of incapacitating agents, drugs that could immobilize or temporarily paralyze a person, hallucinogenic or psychotomimetic drugs whose effects mimic insanity or psychosis. There can be no doubt that their will to resist would be weakened greatly, if not entirely destroyed, by the mass hysteria and panic which would ensue, Green explained. Green proposed that an immediate search be made for a stable chemical compound which could cause mental abnormalities of military significance. He sought drugs that made people irrational. In his monograph, Green provided the Army with a list of 61 materials known to cause mental disorders. These 61 compounds, he said, should be studied and refined to determine which single compound would be the best possible incapacitating agents for U.S. military use. Green requested a budget of $50,000, roughly $500,000 in 2013, which was granted. Research began. Green assigned his colleague and friend, Fritz Hoffmann, the job of researching a multitude of toxins for potential military use. Fritz Hoffmann was by now recognized at Edgewood as one of the most gifted organic chemists in the Chemical Corps. If anyone could find and prepare the ideal incapacitating agent for the battlefield, Hoffmann could. He began a broad spectrum of research on everything from well-known street drugs to highly obscure toxins from the Third World. There was mescaline, obtained from the peyote cactus and used by Native American Indians, with side effects ranging from divination to boredom. He studied fly agaric, a hallucinogenic mushroom found on the barren slopes of Mongolia and rumored to facilitate contact with the spirit world, and piruri, a toxic vegetable leaf from Australia used by Aborigines that was found to suppress thirst. Yaxi and Ipina from Venezuela, Colombia, and Brazil caused people to see things that weren't really there. It was a drug that for centuries had been used by primitive tribes to escape the realities of their plight by using hallucinogenic properties. Soon, Hoffmann would travel the world in search of these incapacitating agents on behalf of the Chemical Corps. Dr. Green's idea of psychochemical warfare would have a profound effect on the future of the U.S. Army's Chemical Corps, but it would also greatly affect the direction of the newest civilian intelligence organization in Washington, the CIA. The agency had deep pockets and big ideas. For the CIA, using drugs to incapacitate individuals had many more applications than just on the battlefield, and the agency began developing programs of its own. Fritz Hoffmann and L. Wilson Green were at the locus of a growing partnership being forged between the Chemical Corps and the CIA. Soon, biological warfare experts from Camp Dietrich would also be brought into the fold. This particular biological weapons program, which would be run by a group called Special Operations Division, or SO Division, was fueled by Operation Paperclip and would develop into one of the most controversial and collaborative efforts in the history of the CIA. It had been a year and a half since the Merck report on the biological weapons threat had been released, and an influx of congressional funding had transformed Camp Dietrich into a state-of-the-art bioweapons research and development facility. The Army purchased 545 acres of land adjacent to what had been called Area A and created a new area designated Area B, where some of Dietrich's first post-war field tests with crop dusters and spray hoses would occur. During the war, dangerous pathogens like anthrax and X had been tested and cultured inside Dietrich's germ lab. A rudimentary wooden building covered in black tar paper and nicknamed the Black Maria by scientists. During the war, an industrial-sized boiler used for fermenting sat on the lawn outside the germ lab. Now, given the scope of work planned for the immediate future, Dietrich needed an aerosol chamber that was bigger and better than anything else like it in the world. The job of designing such a structure was assigned to a bacteriologist named Dr. Harold Batchelor. Dietrich's British counterparts at Porton Down had an excellent chamber of their own, but it fit only two or three mice. What Batchelor came up with was a monstrous, spherical, 1 million liter chamber called the Eight Ball, shaped like a giant's golf ball and held upright by iron legs. The Chicago Bridge and Ironworks was commissioned to build the Eight Ball to specifications that made it airtight and bomb-proof. The Eight Ball was to have portholes, doors, and hatchways, and steel walls of 1.5 inches. Inside the Eight Ball, airflow would simulate weather systems, with scientists on the outside controlling temperatures on the inside within a range of 55 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit. Humidity could be controlled inside the Eight Ball to fluctuate between 30 and 100%. This state-of-the-art environmental control would allow Dietrich scientists to understand how aerosolized biological agents would work at different altitudes in the open air. The sphere would weigh more than 131 tons and would stand 4 stories tall. A catwalk around its center would allow scientists to observe, through portholes, the test subjects sitting inside as they were exposed to the world's deadliest germs. The Chicago Bridge and Ironworks agreed to a delivery date of 1949. With the chamber's design complete, Dr. Batchelor prepared to travel to Germany. There was an important German scientist who was just now becoming available for an interview. This was a man who knew more than almost anyone else in the world about biological weapons. He was particularly knowledgeable about weaponized bubonic plague. The physician was Dr. Kurt Blomme, the former Deputy Surgeon General of the Third Reich. He had just been acquitted of war crimes at the Nuremberg doctor's trial. Now he was back on the paperclip list. The doctor's trial had been over for 42 days. It was October 2, 1947, and a message from Heidelberg, marked Secret Confidential, arrived on the desk of the chief of the chemical corps. It read, "Available now for interrogation on biological warfare matters is Dr. Kurt Blomme." A meeting was arranged for November 10, 1947, between Blomme and Batchelor. Present alongside Dr. Batchelor were Dietrich doctors named Dr. Charles R. Phillips, a specialist in desterilization, and Dr. Donald W. Falconer, an explosives expert, and a Dr. A. W. Gorlick, a dosage expert. Lieutenant R. W. Swanson represented the U.S. Navy, and Lieutenant Colonel Warren S. Leroy represented the Army's European Command Headquarters. An interpreter and a stenographer were also present. Dr. Blomme was told in advance that everything discussed would be classified. Dr. Batchelor spoke first, setting the tone for the all-day affair. "We have come to interview Dr. Blomme personally as well as professionally," Batchelor said. "We have friends in Germany, scientific friends, and this is an opportunity for us to enjoy meeting Dr. Blomme and to discuss our various problems with him." "To begin," Batchelor asked, "would it be possible for Dr. Blomme to give us an overall picture of the information that he has, the nature of the world under discussion?" Blomme spoke in English, pausing on occasion for the interpreter to help him with a word. In 1943, I received orders from Göring for all the research of biological warfare, Blomma explained. All the research for BW would fall under the name cancer research. Cancer research had already started long before that, and I was already working all the time, but in order to keep this development secret, the Reich disguised it. Dr. Blomma laid out the command structure of those involved in biological weapons work under Himmler, and where the men were now. It was a surprisingly small group of around 20 men. As head of the Reich Research Council, Blomma explained, Göring was at the top as the Reich's dictator of science. There were three men in equal positions directly under Göring, Dr. Blomma explained. Blomma was in charge of all research and development of pathogens. Doctors and scientists working in this area reported to him. Major General Dr. Walter Schreiber, the Russians' surprise witness at Nuremberg and the man who had pointed the finger at Blomma, was in charge of vaccines, antidotes, and serums for biological weapons. All doctors and scientists working in these areas ultimately reported to Schreiber. Finally, Blomma explained, Field Marshal Wilhelm Keitel oversaw the Lightning Rod Committee, Blitzableiter, the code name for the ordnance experts who worked on delivery systems for biological bombs. Anyone conducting tests with these kinds of weapons had to go through Keitel. Göring had committed suicide, and Keitel had been hanged at Nuremberg after the trial of the major war criminals. Major General Walter Schreiber was working for the Russians now. It appeared that Dr. Blomma was the last available man standing with extensive inside knowledge of the Third Reich's bioweapons program. Dr. Gorlick asked, "Can Dr. Blomma give us actual locations of various laboratories?" Blomma spoke of the Reich's outpost on the island of Reims, a facility that specialized in sickness of cattle research, including Rinderpest and foot-and-mouth disease. Blomma said that because the isle was completely isolated except by wire, it was a perfect place to conduct this kind of dangerous research. The scientist in charge of the laboratory was Professor Otto Waldmann, and his assistant was Eric Traub, of international fame. Blomma was referring to the fact that before the war, Traub spent several years in America doing research at the Rockefeller Institute in New Jersey. Rinderpest was a terrible disease, Blomma said. In many ways, it was the biological weapon he feared most. Germany depended on milk and butter for 60% of her fat resources, said Blomma. In 1944, it would have resulted in a great catastrophe if foot and mouth disease had been used against Germany. It would have been the greatest catastrophe ever faced, according to Blomma, if a country relies on all its fat resources to get milk and butter. Once the disease starts, there is no stopping it. The Dietrich scientists were very interested to learn more. How did the Reich acquire and develop the pathogen? Batchelor asked. Blomma had already explained this to the Operation Alsace interrogators, but that was 2 years ago, before the doctor's trial, and apparently these Dietrich scientists were not familiar with what Blomma had said when he was at Dustbin. By international law, it was prohibited to have the virus for this sickness in Europe, Blomma said. The virus was in Turkey, and Himmler ordered that for the Isle. Blomma confirmed that Dr. Eric Traub went to Turkey on direct orders from Himmler and acquired a strain of the dangerous virus there. At Reims, Traub then succeeded in producing a dry form of the virus. Dry forms were the deadliest of all, said Blomma. After a period of 7 months based on experimentation on the Isle, this virus was still effective. After 7 months, they still spread and the cattle were all infected. Blome then spoke of experimental tests conducted by Luftwaffe pilots in Russia, where the disease was sprayed from low-flying aircraft over fields of grazing cattle. "Positive results," said Blome. Where were Dr. Traub and Dr. Waldman now? I believe that they have been taken prisoner of the Russians, and they are still active in their research for the Russians, Blome said. The conversation shifted to plague research at Posen, where Blome had set up an institute during the war. "Perhaps we would like to talk about the human angle," Dr. Phillips asked, trying to veil the uncomfortable subject by using the royal we. Dr. Blome had been acquitted of war crimes charges 5 weeks earlier. 7 of his co-defendants were to be hanged. Clearly, the subject of experiments on humans was not something he was going to discuss. The question was rephrased. What did Blome believe was the most groundbreaking biological weapons work conducted by the Reich? Blome said that at Posen, he had been working at dispersing biological agents in a combination with gas that affects the throat. When membranes are hurt, that is, damaged, bacteria have a better chance to infect, Blome said. Dr. Phillips rephrased his question again. Everyone wanted to know about the human experiments. It was the ultimate forbidden knowledge that Nazis possessed. Perhaps we would like to talk about the human angle, which was, I think, Cleve's work, he said. Blome was no fool. Professor Cleve has not worked himself with experiments, Blome said. Heinrich Cleve performed intelligence work. He was in charge of keeping tabs on the biological weapons programs being pursued by nations at war with the Reich. Cleve investigated Polish and Russian sabotage, Blome said. The activity here was not to cause an epidemic amongst the population, merely to kill certain people. The Dietrich doctors were intrigued by this line of conversation and asked Dr. Blome to explain further. During the war, Polish resistance fighters in Posen had succeeded in assassinating about 20 people, Blome said, most of whom were SS officers. A lot of cases of typhoid, said Blome. The waiters in restaurants took fountain pens filled with the inoculum and injected the inoculum into the soup or the food on their way to and from the dining room. This has been proved. Polish resistance movement was heading all these activities. A German-Polish woman doctor who was working in the hospital and got hold of the bacteria and forwarded it to the other people. Were any preventative measures taken? Dr. Phillips asked. Blome explained that there was an extensive and well-funded Reich research program going on in the field of vaccines, antidotes, and serums against many pathogens and diseases, from cholera to parrot virus to plague. But Blome explained that the holy grail of biological weapons research was the plague. I believe the only thing of danger to Germany would have been the plague, because for propaganda reasons, the plague got more attention than any others, Blome added. People all over the world believe it is the worst sickness there is. Dr. Phillips wanted to learn more about the use of live vaccines in Blome's plague research. Schreiber, as the head of the department, epidemics, had very good vaccine material on hand for typhoid, paratyphoid, cholera, diphtheria, and Ruhr, Blome explained. For the plague, they had serum on hand, but the serum was not very powerful. It was very weak. They did not have any vaccine, so I started to build an institute which has never been completed. On occasion, Blome said, he worked in concert with Schreiber's vaccine research laboratory to provide them with good vaccine material, meaning the germs. Which laboratories? Asked Dr. Falconer. In the medical laboratory in Berlin, said Bloma. There was an official appointed only for research of epidemics, Professor Schreiber. Was he under Cleva? Dr. Phillips asked, apparently still unaware that Professor Schreiber was the same Dr. Schreiber who had testified at Nuremberg. If, at Nuremberg, the Russians meant to send a message to American biological weapons makers with Schreiber's testimony, this had gone over the head of these bacteriologists from Camp Dietrich. Bloma repeated that Schreiber was in the same position as I would be under Göring for my cancer researches, so this man was directly under Göring, meaning Bloma and Schreiber were equals in the Reich's chain of command. They were also arch-enemies. Schreiber is a Russian PW, prisoner of war, and everybody who knew Schreiber is convinced he is working for them, said Bloma. In this world of intense suspicion, of deviance and trickery, it was impossible to know who was lying and who was telling the truth. The time came to have a meal. In closing this particular angle, we express our gratitude to Dr. Bloma for his wholehearted cooperation, Dr. Batchelor said. He suggested that they all have dinner together, pleasant talk. During that time, we will not discuss this matter, Batchelor said, as if the Americans had not just tried to hang Dr. Bloma for war crimes, as if Bloma had not been a hardcore Nazi ideologue and member of the inner circle, or had not worn the Golden Party badge. Pleasantries were exchanged, and the meeting was adjourned. After the meeting, the Dietrich doctors requested from the Army Chemical Corps everything they knew about Dr. Eric Traub. That Dr. Bloma said he was most afraid of an outbreak of cattle plague was serious news. Traub was the world's leading expert in the disease. Now the U.S. Army wanted him as their own. Dr. Traub was a virologist, microbiologist, and professor, and a doctor of veterinary medicine. He had been the second in command at the Reich's State Research Institute at Reims since 1942. He was also an expert in Newcastle disease, a contagious bird flu that he was rumored to have weaponized. The Chemical Corps knew that Traub spoke fluent English, that he had dark brown hair, gray-brown eyes, and two pronounced saber scars on his face, on the forehead and upper lip. And they knew that from 1932 until 1938, Traub had been a staff member at the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research in New Jersey. But after the meeting with Dr. Bloma, the Chemical Corps wanted more information on Traub, and they tracked down two of his former American colleagues for interviews. One of them, Dr. Little, described Traub as a domineering German and a surly-type individual with a violent temper. Another colleague, Dr. John Nelson, found that despite long training in the care of animals, Traub went out of his way to be cruel to animals. This troubled Nelson, who felt that any person who is cruel to animals shows little distinction and difference to his treatment of his fellow human beings. Before the war, Traub was given the opportunity to stay in America and continue his research full-time. He chose to return to Germany, citing loyalty to the Reich. In 1939, Traub was drafted into the Wehrmacht Veterinary Corps, and in 1940, he was elevated to captain and fought in the campaign against France. He was a member of several Nazi organizations, including the National Sozialisten Kraftfahrer Corps, NSKK, or National Socialist Motor Corps, the National Socialist People's Welfare, NSV, and the Reichsluftschutzbund, RLB, or State Air Protection Corps. Dr. Traub's talents as a virologist had been identified, and he had been pulled back from the front lines and assigned to biological weapons work. According to Bloma, Traub was the most talented scientist working on anti-animal research, biological weapons designed to kill the animals that a nation relies upon most for food. At the end of the war, when the Reims lab fell to the Russians, with it went Dr. Traub, his wife Blanca, and their three children. The laboratory was renamed the Land Office 2 for Animal Epidemic Diseases, and the Soviets put Traub back to work on bioweapons research. Now, in 1947, the Army began a plan to lure Traub away. As for Dr. Bloma, the scientist from Dietrich knew it was far too risky to offer him a paperclip contract just weeks after he'd been acquitted of capital war crimes at Nuremberg. Drew Pearson's reporting on the paperclip contract offered to Karl Krau in prison had upset General Eisenhower and nearly brought the program to its knees. While Bloma made clear his willingness to work for the Army, the Dietrich scientist knew he would have to remain an under-the-radar consultant, relegated to the JOA target list for potential hire at a future date. The Army bacteriologist and biological weapons expert Dr. Harold Batchelor returned to Camp Dietrich with many new ideas to explore, including assassination by poison techniques that had been shared with him by Dr. Bloma. The Reich had been researching biological weapons that would initiate epidemics, but could also kill certain people, according to Bloma. In 1947, however, with scientific frontiers opening up wide, there would be hundreds of new ways to assassinate individuals using a single device carrying a biological or chemical agent. This was an area in which the CIA was interested. The Chemical Corps had the perfect scientist for the job of exploring poisons that could be used for individual assassinations, Fritz Hoffmann. But Hoffmann had a backlog of work. He still had to figure out how to synthesize tabin gas so the Chemical Corps could hurry up and begin producing it on an industrial scale. Chapter 16. Headless Monster. In June 1948, Colonel Charles E. Lukes, the man who oversaw the paperclip scientists at Edgewood, was made Brigadier General and transferred to Heidelberg. Lukes now served as Chief of Intelligence Collection for Chemical Warfare Plans, European Command. In Heidelberg, he had access to a whole new group of Hitler's former chemists, from those who had been at the top of the chain of command on down. Within weeks of his arrival, Lukes formed a working relationship with Richard Kuhn, the former director of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Medical Research in Heidelberg. Because Kuhn had an international profile before and during the war, he was a problematic candidate for Operation Paperclip. Though Kuhn had once been revered among scientists, Samuel Goudsmit of Operation Alsace was never afraid to remind colleagues that Kuhn had become an active Nazi during the war, and that he began his lectures with Sieg Heil and the Nazi salute. Kuhn had lied to Goudsmit in a post-war interview, swearing that he had never worked on Reich projects during the war. In fact, Kuhn was a chemical weapons expert for the Reich and developed Soman nerve agent. Soman was even deadlier than sarin and tabin, but considered too delicate and therefore too costly to industrialize. Richard Kuhn began working with General Lukes in Heidelberg on chemical weapons projects for the Chemical Corps. General Lukes's friendly relationship with Richard Kuhn drew ire from the British. When formally queried about his professional partnership with Kuhn, Lukes replied, "I was under the impression that Professor Kuhn had been cleared of his Nazi complicity, or had suffered the penalty, and is now in the good graces of both the British and the Americans." Further, wrote Lukes, "I am sure our people are certainly familiar with his background." To General Lukes, moving forward on military programs considered vital to U.S. national security was more important than dredging up an individual's Nazi past. Through the lens of history, this remains one of the most complicated issues regarding Operation Paperclip. When working with ardent Nazis, some American handlers appear to have developed an ability to look the other way. Others, like General Lukes, looked straight at the man and saw only the scientist, not the Nazi. Richard Kuhn had a connection with a scientist in Switzerland with whom General Lukes was particularly interested in working. The scientist had been investigating a little-known incapacitating agent that was far more potent than anything the Chemical Corps was working on at the time. This Swiss chemist had recently given a lecture, New Hallucinatory Agent, to a gathering of the Swiss Society of Psychiatry and the Association of Physicians in Zurich. On December 16, 1948, General Lukes took a trip to Switzerland. So as not to draw attention to himself or the U.S. military, he took the unusual step of taking off his military uniform. This story does not appear in any known declassified Army record, but is told in Lukes's own words, in his personal diaries that were left to the U.S. Army Heritage Center in Pennsylvania. "Went back to the house and put on civilian clothes," Lukes wrote in his diary. His wife, Pearl, took the plain-clothed general to the train station. En route to his destination in Switzerland, Lukes shared a compartment with a foreigner, dark, nationality unknown, and a Dutchman who acted Jewish in quizzing me all about myself. The train compartment, Lukes noted, provided a clean, comfortable, well-lit ride, and General Lukes arrived in Bern at 8:55 that night. Before heading to bed, Lukes enjoyed a fire in the fireplace in his hotel room. General Lukes did not note in his journal any of the details of the meeting with the mysterious Swiss scientist. The mission was classified. Lukes returned to Germany the following day, and he did note in his journal that Richard Kuhn came over to his house for lunch with a special guest, Dr. Gerhard Schroeder, the inventor of Preparation 991, or Tabengas. With snow coming down outside the Lukes' home in Flurries, Richard Kuhn, Dr. Gerhard Schroeder, and General Lukes had a pleasant chat and a lunch of pork chops. Decades later, in a speech prepared for the Amherst chapter of the Daughters of the American Revolution and the Sons of the American Revolution, General Lukes revealed that the Swiss chemist referred to him by Richard Kuhn had been Professor Werner Stoll, a psychiatric researcher at the University of Zurich. The hallucinatory agent that Lukes was after in Switzerland would be the ultimate incapacitation chemical, also sought by L. Wilson Green at Edgewood to knock out, not kill. The chemical, said Lukes, was called lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD. Stoll did not discover LSD. That distinction went to Albert Hoffman, a chemist for Sandoz Pharmaceutical Company in Basel. Werner Stoll, a colleague of Hoffman's, and the son of Sandoz chief chemist Arthur Stoll, repeated Albert Hoffman's original LSD experiment and concluded, "Modified LSD-25 was a psychotropic compound that was non-toxic and could have enormous use as a psychiatric aid." In 1947, Werner Stoll had published the first article on LSD in the Swiss Archives of Neurology. Stoll's second paper, entitled "A New Hallucinatory Agent, Active in Very Small Amounts," was published 2 years later in 1949. But General Lukes did not see LSD as a psychiatric aid, but rather as a weapon, an incapacitating agent with enormous potential on the battlefield. Soon, the Army and the Navy would all be experimenting with LSD as a weapon, and the CIA would be experimenting with LSD as a means of controlling human behavior, an endeavor that soon came to be known as mind control. Eventually, physicians and chemists from Operation Paperclip would work on jointly operated, classified programs codenamed Chatter, Bluebird, Artichoke, MKUltra, and others. LSD, the drug that induces paranoia and unpredictability and makes people see things that are not really there, would become a strange allegory for the Cold War. One day in the late summer of 1948, a call came in to Brigadier General Charles Lukes's new office in Heidelberg. A lieutenant answered the phone. The caller, a German, left a cryptic message to be relayed to General Lukes. It was short and to the point. "I can help," the caller said. He left a return telephone number and his name, Schieber. General Lukes had been in Germany since June. As chief of intelligence collection for chemical warfare plans in Europe, it was Lukes's job to determine which Western European countries were developing chemical weapons and to monitor their progress. Lukes was also working on unfinished business back at Edgewood, namely the continuing failure by the Chemical Corps to develop industrial-scale production of nerve gas, an effort that by now had officially switched from the pursuit of Tabin to the pursuit of sarin. The American university professors Lukes had hired back in the U.S. were making very little progress. "We put samples of sarin in front of them and everything, but yet they could not come up with any process to make some sarin," General Lukes explained decades later in an oral history for the U.S. Army. A fire in the sarin plant at Edgewood had set the program back even further. Along came the Schieber call. In 1947, a thick Omgus security report had been compiled on SS Brigade Führer Dr. Walter Schieber. He had been involved with the U.S. Army since the fall of the Reich. Schieber was a Nazi Bonzen, a big wheel. He was unattractive, fat, and wore a Hitler mustache and false teeth. Since the 1920s, he had been regarded as one of Hitler's Ilstekampfe, the old fighters, trusted members of Hitler's inner circle who wore the Golden Party badge. Dr. Schieber was also a loyal SS man and served on the personal staff of Heinrich Himmler. SS Brigadefuhrer Dr. Walter Schieber had been a dedicated and loyal member of the Nazi Party since 1931. He had also been frequently photographed alongside Hitler, Himmler, Bormann, and Speer as part of the inner circle. A number of these photographs survived the war, which made public dealings with Schieber impossible. U.S. Army transactions with him were classified top secret. As head of the Reich Ministry of Armaments Supply Office, Rüstungslieferungsamt, first under Fritz Todt when the ministry was called the Munitions Ministry, or Organization Todt, and then under Albert Speer, Schieber was an engineer and a chemist, and handled business in both areas for the Third Reich. As an engineer, he oversaw many of the Reich's underground engineering projects. Designs for concentration camp armaments factories remained almost the exclusive work of Schieber, writes Michael Thad Allen, an expert on the SS and slave labor. Schieber also wore his chemist hat for at least one concentration camp experiment. In an attempt to save the SS money and address the growing problem of food shortages among slave laborers, Schieber designed a nourishment program called Eastern Nutrition, Ostliche Kostform. It was tested at the Mauthausen concentration camp. For a period of 6 months, starting in December 1943, a group of 150 slave laborers were denied the watery broth they usually received and instead were fed an artificial paste designed by Schieber and made up of cellulose remnants, or pieces of used clothing. 116 of the 150 test subjects died. After the war, there was a judicial inquiry into Schieber's Eastern Nutrition Program. The West German courts determined that the resulting deaths could not necessarily be attributed to nutrition because there were so many other causes of death in the concentration camp. Walter Schieber was further linked to the deaths of hundreds, if not thousands, of slave laborers through the various chemical weapons programs that were carried out at Farben's multiple production plants. Schieber was not tried at Nuremberg, but was used as a witness for the prosecution instead. During the war, with his expertise as a chemist, SS Brigade Führer Dr. Walter Schieber was the Speer Ministry's liaison to IG Farben, and he oversaw the industrial production of tabin and sarin gas. According to his intelligence file, one of his titles was Confidential Clerk of IG Farben AG. Dr. Walter Schieber and Dr. Otto Ambrose worked together at the Duhernfort nerve agent production facility. By the late summer of 1948, Otto Ambrose had been tried and convicted at Nuremberg and was serving an 8-year sentence at Landsberg prison for mass murder and slavery. Schieber had been released from his obligations as a witness for the tribunal and was a free man. Now, here he was on the telephone, requesting to speak with Brigadier General Lukes. Schieber was looking for work with the U.S. Army Chemical Corps. "I'm free now," Schieber told Lukes's lieutenant during the call. "They have nothing against me." It was, of course, more complicated than that. 4 months prior, in February 1948, former SS Brigade Führer Walter Schieber had signed a top-secret Project Paperclip contract with the JOA. He had been recruited by Colonel Putt at Wright Field, now Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Putt wanted to make use of Schieber's underground engineering skills, just as George Rickey's skills had been used before Rickey was returned to Germany to stand trial for war crimes. Hiring a top Nazi like Walter Schieber was risky, and the potential problems facing the U.S. Air Force for doing so were candidly discussed in an exchange of memorandums. A JOA case officer wrote to military headquarters in Frankfurt, summarizing how things were progressing. "Subject is Dr. Walter Schieber. Requested priority shipment to Wright Field. Schieber's ability is outstanding, and his potentialities believed invaluable to the United States. For the past 3 months," the case officer explained, "Schieber had been working on the Underground Factory Project, a massive undertaking at U.S. military headquarters in Germany. The project was spearheaded by Franz Dorsch, and Schieber had been working as Dorsch's first assistant. In Germany, Schieber and Dorsch had supervised 150 scientists and technicians who had built underground factories for the Reich. The result was a 1,000-page monograph for the U.S. Air Force. Schieber," the report explained, "had been especially cooperative and is agreeable to going to the United States. He is well known to the Soviets and is desired by them. His exploitation in the United States is therefore believed highly desirable." There was, however, a problem that needed to be addressed, wrote the case officer. "His party record is as follows. Entered party in June 31. Brigade Führer in the SS. Holder of the Golden Party Badge. Member of SS. DAF, Deutsche Arbeitsfront, or German Labor Front, NSV, National Sozialistin Volkswohlfahrt, or National Socialist People's Welfare, and VDCH, or Association of German Chemists." There was no way to disguise that Schieber had been in Hitler's inner circle, but the Joa also proposed a solution. In order to minimize the possibility of unfavorable publicity in the United States, your views requested on advisability of shipping subject via air, under escort, or under an alias. Schieber could be part of Project Paperclip as long as no one knew who Schieber really was. Unlike standard operating procedure with Operation Paperclip applicants, there was to be no photograph of SS Brigade Führer Dr. Walter Schieber attached to his intelligence file. The Air Force agreed with Joa's suggestions. Ship Dr. Walter Schieber to Wright Field, Dayton, Ohio. Air Force requests case be expedited and given top priority. There was one caveat that Joa and the Air Force agreed upon. Dr. Schieber had to undergo a denazification trial first. Trusting he would be placed in Class 3, the category for individuals who were less incriminated, after his denazification trial, Dr. Walter Schieber packed his bags and awaited transport to the United States. Instead, on March 11, 1948, a different verdict came in. The civilian internee, Dr. Walter Schieber, born 13/09/1897 at Beimerstetten, former chief of armaments deliveries on the Reich Ministry for Armaments and War Production, head of the Central Office for Generators, deputy head of the Reich Organization Industry, SS Brigade Führer, presently held at this enclosure, read the decree, was tried by the Sonderspruchkammer for Hesse, Neustadt Lager, and sentenced to Group 2, 2 years labor camp and restriction to 5 years ordinary labor. The Group 2 designation meant that Schieber was in a category with party activists, militarists, and profiteers. His paperclip contract would have to wait. 5 days after his trial, Schieber contacted the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps to relay to his paperclip handler his version of events. Herr Burbeth, the judge, had subject brought into the chamber and asked him about his trip to the United States, to which Schieber replied that he did not think it would be wise for him to go to the U.S. as an offender. Herr Burbeth suggested that he should immediately apply for a retrial or ask the Minister for Political Liberation for a pardon. Herr Burbeth also told Schieber that he would recommend such a pardon. Schieber told his paperclip handler that after leaving the courtroom, he had returned to the internee camp where he was being held. Then, according to Schieber, something rather shocking happened. Burbeth, of the court, joined Schieber and told him, contrary to his previous statement, not to apply for another trial or a pardon, but to go to Frankfurt immediately, contact the Russian liaison officer, and ask for an interzonal pass. With this pass, subject Schieber was to enter the Russian zone and proceed to one of his factories in the Schwarzsaale, where he could be assured of every possible help, should he have the desire to work in his former position. In other words, according to Schieber, the judge at this trial worked for the Russians and was offering him a job. Schieber claimed to have told the judge that his offer sounded impossible. Was he really being advised to ignore the court's judgment, to flee the camp, get an interzonal pass, and begin working for the Russians at a high pay grade comparable to what he was paid during the Hitler regime? The president of the Spruckhammer assured me that arrangements would be made, Schieber said. Did this really happen? Was the judge a Russian mole? Or was Schieber playing the Americans with the proverbial Russian card? Schieber's counterintelligence corps handler asked him what he thought of the judge's black market offer. Schieber believes that the Spruckhammer sentence was imposed to prevent his contract with the United States and to make his residence in Germany so difficult as to force him to accept the Russian offers. The handler had his own thoughts. Cancellation of Schieber's contract after he has possibly jeopardized his safety and after he's cooperated so wholeheartedly with intelligence agencies here is certain to have an adverse